Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome, welcome. It's a privilege to be involved in such a lovely situation. It's such a lovely occasion. Afternoon, we can hear a bit of music, Rosh Chodesh Adar. I think people need something to pick them up a little bit. It's better than watching the news, that's for sure. So we can connect together and celebrate Rosh Chodesh a little bit and get to learn a little bit of Torah as well in this context. I'd like to give you a short presentation, 45 minutes, which is a little bit different from what I normally do. And you'll immediately see the difference. If you look at your source sheet, you'll see that page 1 has a few classic sources, 1, 2, and 3, 4. And then you've got a playlist. And then on the reverse of the sheet, you haven't got classic sources, but classical sources. You've got a piece of a little bit of music. Now, I'm not assuming that everybody here can read music. There probably are a few people here that can read music. But it doesn't matter if you can't, because what we're going to discuss will be pretty clear, I think, either way. Let me introduce myself a little bit, maybe with what are my credentials for speaking on an occasion in an afternoon such as this. So some of you know me already, and obviously from my accent you can hear that I'm English. I come here wearing three different hats. Which is more than I usually wear. Normally when I give shiurim, I speak in the OU, I speak here, I speak there. I only wear one hat. The one hat is the most recent hat, which is I'm a teacher, I run a midrasha, I run a seminary for gap year students, for young women. I give shiurim here and there. We lived many years, Baruch Hashem, in Har Nof, gave lots of shiurim there, and we live now in Gush Etzion, in Alon Shvut, and so I speak all over the place. So that you know already. That's classic rabbinic, halachic, hashkafic stuff. But before that, I wore another hat for many years, which was a legal hat. I was a corporate real estate lawyer for many years in England, and I studied law at Oxford undergraduate. In England, undergraduate law study is a thing. In America, it's not yet. I'm surprised, because it's a very interesting undergraduate study to do, even if you don't become a lawyer. But I studied a degree called jurisprudence, which is just a fancy way of saying law, basically. But in theory, it's more the philosophy of law. Why the law does what it does, how it does it, etc. And I did that at Oxford when I was a student. And then I went on to law school. I met my wife. She was also at Oxford studying jurisprudence. That's where we met. And she went on to do far more sensible things and not become a lawyer. But I did become a lawyer. I went to law school and practiced for many years. But I don't worry, I've done tshuva now. I'm not a lawyer anymore. I have repented. I've done what Rabbi Beryl Wein, who was also a lawyer, but of course even before he was a lawyer, he was a Talmid Chacham Atzum. But he uses the line, he left the prophets of the law for the law of the prophets. So that's his line, and I did that. So that's a second hat, which is a legal hat, and I want to talk a bit about law and the philosophy of halakha today. But there's a third hat, which I don't know if you know that I wear, or at least I used to wear, which is I was a musician. And as an amateur, pretty sort of average musician, I was pretty good for average. I was never really professional. I did fleetingly think about becoming a professional musician, but was persuaded that was a very silly idea because I wouldn't have a regular parnassa, as I'd better be a lawyer, which is ironic because I ended up in chinuch. So the lawyer angle didn't stay for too long. But from when I was a small child, I played the violin. And I played in many orchestras as a small child, as a larger child, and as I played as a teenager. And when I was at Oxford, actually, I played a lot of orchestral stuff. And I actually had my own orchestra. I was a conductor for 2 years of the Oxford Chamber Orchestra. I've got the posters at home to prove it. And we put on a number of performances of Mozart, of Beethoven. One of my best friends was a very good pianist who went on to become quite an eminent piano teacher. He had his debut Symphony of the Emperor's Piano Concerto, Beethoven Piano Concerto, with me in the orchestra. So I wear that hat as well. And I'm saying that's not a hat that I normally wear, and I certainly never combine all three. But today, I want to try and do that a little bit, combine all three, and I want to talk for 20 minutes or so on the halachic side, and then I want to play you some music. I'm not going to play my violin. I'm sorry, I'm a bit out of practice. These days I'm a kind of Purim and birthday parties violinist. And on Purim it's always a little bit better after I've had a couple of glasses of wine. And I haven't had those today, so I'm not going to play the violin. We could arrange it, thank you, okay, fine. Okay, maybe another time. But for now I'll play you on the sound system here. So what do I want to talk about? The title of the presentation is Halacha as a Symphony. What does that mean? And this is not my shiur, if you like. This is a presentation that I heard many years ago, probably 25 years ago, by someone who was my teacher and who I learned a great deal of insight into these things from, who was Rabbi Nathan Lopez Cordoza. Rabbi Cordoza probably is well known to many of you, and he gave this, which itself was originally a shiur by Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz of Skokie. So this shiur has provenance. It goes from Rabbi Berkowitz and Skokie to Rabbi Cordoza, and I'd like to present it to you today. Rabbi Cordoza actually wrote this up as a full essay, which you can pick up from his website, and I recommend that. It's a very good essay. It's much more broad than I have the time to do today. But this is basically the idea he presents, and the question is obvious. The question is, what is the purpose of halakha? Why? Why is halakha as detailed, as minute in its attention to detail as it is? No other system in the world has this. There is none. Even Islam, which has a legal base underpinning it, doesn't have anything close to the level of complexity of halakha. As we know, there are 613 mitzvot, which is not really true. There are far more than 613 mitzvot. Even the Ramban, who is counting the 613 mitzvot, eventually says, you know something? You're right, there are thousands of mitzvot, but I'd like to try and get them into 613 if we can traditionally. But those thousands of mitzvot fan out into tens of thousands of principles and into hundreds of thousands of details. I don't know if anyone's ever estimated how many details of halacha there are. I wouldn't be surprised if there are well over a million. Why is that? And of course, halacha regulates the biggest issues in life. What is the status of a Jewish state? When is it legitimate to go to war? What are our obligations to the environment and climate change? These are all things that halacha talks about. And it talks about tiny, tiny issues. How do I tie my shoelaces? How should I take the bones out of my fish on Shabbos? What if a drop of milk splashes into my chicken soup? And also very personal issues. How do I behave in the bathroom? How do I conduct a sexual life? How do I relate to my touching my cousins and my relatives, etc.? Why? Why are these things so much part of a halakhic system? And I want to look at a few different angles on this and a few questions with this, and maybe give a solution, which is Rabbi Cordoza's solution, and then back it up with a little bit of musical accompaniment. First of all, I think the question that people normally ask is the question which is not relevant, which is, why does God care about this detail? And if you think about it for 2 minutes, that's a completely illogical question. Meaning, how could I possibly know what God cares about or what God doesn't care about in an intuitive way? Meaning, I have a revealed Torah, we have Nevuah, we have prophecy, whereby we know what God has communicated to mankind that he does care about. But how could I intuit that, well, surely God is much more, you know, big picture than to worry about my bones in my fish. Why would you say that? If you're thinking big picture, look at the universe and ask, why does God care what happens to the entire solar system? The entire solar system is no more relevant than the bones in my fish on an infinite scale. So I don't think it's legitimate to ask a question like, why does God care? We have the Torah is revealed, we have Nevuah. This is clearly what we're told that God cares about. I can't intuit otherwise. But the questions which I think are more relevant are, isn't it restricting? Halachic rules make me into a bit of a robot. What about the lofty, emotional, religious ideas of spirituality? Where are they? And actually, you sometimes find that people become a little bit robotic in their halachic observance, and it seems to be a sort of behaviorism. They do this, and they do this, and they do this. A case that I remember, I had a friend who's a little bit OCD, back in the days when people didn't used to call it OCD, and he said, look, I like to take my guests out Dalad Amos from the front door, because that's the right thing to do. So he drew a line with a piece of chalk. He measured, I think he was Chazon Ish, because he wanted to be Machmir, a measurement Dalad Amos from the door. And he goes up to that line, and he stands there, and he waves up. I mean, clearly he's missed the point of that halacha, which is to make people feel that you're, you know, escorting them out because of covet, not that you're being Mekayim a mitzvah. Which is why, by the way, we never make a brocha on a Bein Adam L'Chaveru mitzvah. someone comes collecting at the front door, wants to collect money because they're, you know, poor. So I don't say, oh, Baruch Hashem, stand down, I want to make a bracha on you, a sheik, a shanu, a mitzvah, a sabbath. No, he's not my lulav, I'm not shaking him. You can't do that. So clearly that particular person missed the point. But it restricts us. Why can't I just be who I want to be and express my religiosity in a way which is more personal to me? And what about my sense of autonomy? Do I really need to be told when to wash my hands? I mean, after COVID, clearly we do need to be told when to wash our hands. In England, they told everybody you have to sing happy birthday twice. I don't know if you did they say that in Israel or in America? So we had all these English people are very well behaved, you should know. So for a whole year or two, English people have been washing their hands, singing happy birthday to you, happy birthday. Because that was the length of time. Happy birthday twice was how long you had to wash your hands. So maybe no. Maybe I do need to be told how to wash. But really, can't I work that out for myself? When to do these things. What about spontaneity? You know, why do my tefillin have to be black and square and leather? What if I want pink, fluffy, round tefillin? Because that's what I identify with. I mean, it seems like a strange thing to say, but why not? Priyetz Hadar. I want to take a beautiful fruit. I like bananas. If I want to wave the banana on Sukkot, I'll wave a banana. Like, why can I not express myself in that way? Even mitzvahs which seem to be very value-oriented, like v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. Okay, I get it now. But then there are the details. You learn up the details of v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, and it's not just enough to be, you know, reach out to other people. There's bikur chaylim and hachnasas kala and v'aisameis, etc., etc. There are so many details. I don't think people are coming in and out. You want to close the door? I don't mind closing the door, whatever. We won't hear the music. We'll be louder than they are, don't worry. And philosophically, and this is where I want to come to the source sheet, philosophically, don't we have a problem that we almost put halacha ahead of God? Let me tell you what I mean. Look at this first source on your source sheet. There is a pasuk in Yirmiyahu, where God speaks to Yirmiyahu and laments the fact that the Jewish people have gone off the rails. And look at this pasuk that he says in Yirmiyahu, in chapter 16 of Yirmiyahu. The Amarta Alehem, says God to Yirmiyahu, you have to say to them, Al Asher Azvu Avoisechem Oisi, your fathers have forsaken me, Nu'um Hashem, so speaks God. The Yelchu Achrei Elohim Acherim, they have followed other gods, the Ya'avdum, and they have worshipped them, the Yishtachavu Lehem, and they bow down to them, the Oisei Azavu, they have abandoned me. The et torasi lo shamaru, and they haven't kept my Torah. They've abandoned me, and not only that, they haven't kept the Torah. So Chazal pick up on that. Like, what are you saying? If they abandoned God, why do you care if they didn't keep the Torah? They're already gone. They're finished. They're out of there. So Chazal have a remarkable statement. Source number two in Eicha Rabbah at the beginning in the Petichta, in the opening there. So Rav Huna v'Rav Yirmiyahu v'Shem Rav Chia. So they said the following idea, Rechia bar Abba. Amri, it says, they've said the following, Ksid, v'oisi azavu v'estarasi lo shamaru, they've abandoned me and they haven't even kept my Torah. Halavai, oisi azavu, if only they just abandoned me, the Torah si shamaru. But they kept my Torah. If only they'd abandoned me, but they still kept halacha. Meaning, he's saying to Yirmiyahu, I would rather that they all be atheists. Completely don't believe in God, as long as they keep Shabbos, as long as they hold by the Eruv, as long as they keep kosher. Like, what kind of system is that? Why would that be? So we'll read the end of that soon. But that's a remarkable philosophical statement, which seems to say that we almost worship the halakha. We almost worship the Torah. And by the way, that's a danger. You sometimes see people can turn even Torah into kind of an avodah zarah. The kotel itself can become some kind of an avodah zarah object if you're not careful. There's a beautiful comment, I think it's the Meshech Chochmah. It says, when Moshe Rabbeinu saw them dancing around the eagle when he was carrying the luchos when he came down, he smashed the luchos. Why? Because he thought to himself, if they can dance around the eagle azav, the golden calf today, then tomorrow they'll be dancing around the luchos. And the luchos themselves, the tablets themselves, will become an avodah zarah. So this seems to very much buy into that concern. So how are we going to deal with this? So Christianity, as you know, abandoned halakha. Their whole stance for 2,000 years have been that the law is taking us to Gehenna, not to Gan Eden. That no, abandon the law. The law is keeping you back. Just have a pure heart, believe in God, etc. Even the apparently innocent expression, the devil is in the details.
which albeit is not a very old expression, but that expresses a very Christian idea. The devil is in the details. No, for us, it's not the devil that's in the details. It's reality, the MS. It's the spirituality that's in the details. Christianity, as you know, has been on a 2,000-year polemic against the details. Spinoza, 400 years ago, rejected halakha. He said it's a religious behaviorism. It promotes external action over inner devotion. As you know, Reformed Judaism also abandoned straight away the halakhic system. Kant even said that Judaism may not even be a religion at all. It doesn't do the things that religion are meant to do. It just makes people do this and do that and do this and do that and do the other. He rejected it being a religion at all. And therefore, we need to kind of think, what is the answer to this? How are we going to resolve this? Why do we feel very strongly that halacha is important? And even in areas where you could say, like matzah, for example. Oh, I get it. Matzah. I'll eat some matzah. It'll help me remember the idea of Yetzias Mitzrayim. But do I have to measure this much? And every year get more and more and more and more. So people are getting their little laminated sheets out at the table and measuring the matzah. And I'm not saying that's wrong. Maybe they should. Maybe if they don't know how much matzah to eat, then they should have a little laminated sheet with a measurement. But really, is that what we really need to do? So the answer that Rabbi Cardoza gives, which Rabbi Berkowitz gives, is the answer of Kedusha. And I think this is very apposite, given that we're moving into Vayikra next week. And the whole of Sefer Vayikra is the Sefer of Kedusha. Kedusha of the person, Kedusha of the place, Kedusha of time, of the Chagim, Shabbat, Shemitah, Yovel, etc. What is Kedusha? So I brought you the Pasuk. The Pasuk is well known to everybody here, number 3, at the very beginning here. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe l'mor, daber el kol hadas b'nei Yisrael. This has to be said to the whole Jewish nation, not just a few people. Va'amata aleihem kedoshim tihyu. That's your goal. That's your aspiration. Kedoshim tihyu. Remember the beginning when the mission statement when they came out of Egypt. You're going to be a mamlechet kohanim, v'goy kadosh. Kedoshim tihyu. Ki kadosh ani Hashem Elokeichem. So how do you become kadosh? So Vayikra says exactly the problem that we're trying to deal with. You become kadosh through details. Beit Adam l'chaveru details. Ah, the spotlight has arrived. With the details of Tumah and Tara, details of Korbanos, that's what Sefer Vayikra is all about. The very Sefer of Kedusha is the very Sefer of detail. I remember when I was a kid, I went to a non-Jewish school, and they handed us all, when we arrived there, a new English Bible, which is a Christian Bible translated. And, okay, very nice, got my new English Bible. And the first thing I noticed when I opened up this Bible is that it had two size fonts. There was the big print, and there was the small print. And the whole of Sefer Vayikra, Leviticus, was in the small print. Because that's just Jewish stuff. Old Testament Jewish stuff. All this holiness through purity and impurity and offerings and korbanos, they rejected it completely. And again, we need to understand what it really means to us. So really there are two approaches through history, apart from ours. Christianity basically asked the question, what is the relationship, we asked this question first, between the body and the soul? What is that relationship? And Christianity answered the question as follows. The body is basically beyond hope. There's nothing you can do. Your body is basically an animal. The best thing you can do is try and avoid anything too animalistic. Don't get married if you don't have to. Don't eat nice food if you don't have to. Really, everything is focused on Olam Haba. The soul is the only thing that will really work. It's very pessimistic. There's really nothing you can do to connect the body in any kind of spiritual way. Okay? Very pessimistic answer. The Greeks really answered this in a completely opposite way. If you look at Socrates, if you look at the Greek philosophy, the idea is very optimistic. You know what you should do? You should think and learn and intellectualize and understand these values. And when you really integrate these values into your mind, then your body will follow. Your body will follow that inspiration of the mind and you'll end up doing... Well, that's very optimistic. You know, if you want to be a swimmer, and you do a bachelor's in swimming, and then you do a master's in advanced swimming, and then you do a PhD thesis in swimming and sinking, you know, ideas of buoyancy and the thinking of, you know, the philosophers, you can be the most qualified thinker in swimming, but the minute they throw you in the pool, you're at the bottom. You'll sink. Because the body just doesn't follow the intellect the way we'd like it to. I'm afraid not. Christianity is too pessimistic, and we say, you're right, but you're wrong. And the Greeks were too optimistic, and we say, you're wrong, but you're right. You know, how can they both be right? You're also right. So how does that work? So the way we obviously address this is as follows. The reason that we have a detailed system of halacha is because actions are the way that we understand that we make a difference to our neshama. The neshama and the guf are in constant interaction. And the one thing which is most active in us on a minute-by-minute basis is our body. And the Sefer HaChinuch says, in many different places, specifically in Mitzvah 17, he says, many small actions of the body will eventually have an impact on the soul. For example, the classic question, is it better to give $1,000 to one person or $1 to 1,000 people? There's no question at all that $1 to 1,000 people makes a much bigger impact on the person themselves. And through those actions, that will become a strong influence on the soul. Rabbi Cordoza tells a story, which is his story, but it's a fascinating story. Oh, they're having a really good time in there. Don't worry, we'll soon be having a good time in here as well. He tells a story of he was in a hotel once, and these two gentlemen came up to him and said to him, are you a rabbi? And he said, yeah, sure. They said, well, we got a question because we've asked priests and we've asked pastors and things, and we can't get a good answer to this. We are two American men. We grew up in a religious Christian environment, and we were sent to the Vietnam War. This was many years ago. And they told us we had to kill people. And we couldn't. We couldn't bring ourselves to kill people. And we didn't know how we were going to manage. And at first we had to be forced to do this. But after a while it became something that we did, and we did it more and more. And eventually we began to feel pretty numb to it. And then we began to enjoy it. And then it just became a joke. Who killed more? And we're devastated that this is how we've become. And how can we turn back into the people that we once were? Very interesting question. And Rabbi Cordoza's answer to them was, I don't know for sure, but I think the answer is, start doing small acts of chesed for more and more people, and that those actions themselves will turn you back into a person that appreciates what it is to be a Tzelem Elohim. You can't just sit and think about it. You can't just go to therapy about it. Maybe you have to do that too. But you have to do lots of small acts, tiny acts, that recalibrate the way that we think. And those tiny acts are absolutely essential. You can't do without them. You can't manage without them. Okay, that's positive mitzvot. Positive mitzvot are thousands and thousands of tiny things that we do that affect our neshama in that way and hopefully make an impact. What about negative mitzvahs? So negative mitzvahs is very interesting. There is a relationship between creativity and discipline. If you're a bit Kabbalistic, you can express this as a relationship between chesed and gevura. I gave some shirim on this recently at the OU in terms of art, but chesed is the need the urge to create. I have all this inside of me. This is what I want to give to other people. I want to do things. And gevura says, well, one second, chesed can be destructive. Chesed is undisciplined. You can't just throw paint at the wall and hope to create art. You can't just bang on the piano and hope to create music. That's not how it works. You need to discipline. You need to take that creativity and channel it in a way which is incredibly disciplined by stopping yourself from doing things so that then you'll be able to do the things you do with so much more kavanah, thought, and intention. And therefore, the idea of discipline, of the negative mitzvot, is giving us the control over what we're doing so that when we do it, it has much more meaning. And that complex system of halakha, of lots of tiny positive actions and lots of tiny control negative actions, will hopefully enable us to find a calibration, a system that actually makes that work. And that, at the end of the day, is what halakha is. Halakha is an incredibly detailed system which combines those two things. It combines the positive actions which enable us to impact on ourselves thousands of times a day. Think about it. And we don't do them properly. I mean, I don't do them properly. Think about how it would be if every time we walked past the mezuzah in our house, we just stopped just for a second and thought, ooh, v'ahavta Hashem Elokecha, that's amazing. That's a great mitzvah. And then I get on with my day. It's just walking past. Yeah? People who kiss mezuzahs, that's very nice. That helps. Kissing the mezuzah may help you to think about v'ahavta l'recha kamocha, v'ahavta Hashem Elokecha, rather. But think about the opportunities to do that mitzvah so many times a day and how that would impact on us. Just making a bracha with kavanah, which is very hard to do. Is it meant to be 1,000 times a day, or whatever it is, 100 brachas a day, you have that opportunity to do that. So that's really what halacha is. And this is where the symphony connection comes. Because if you take the mashal that I just said about creativity, I'm a musician, so I want to now put this into the symphony moshel. Rabbi Cardoza said a very interesting story. I remember he told me this personally. There was a fellow that lived next door to him in Beit Vagan, and he was a violinist. And he played, practiced every day. And one particular season, he was practicing Beethoven's violin concerto. So you know what the walls are like in apartments in Yerushalayim. You can hear everything that's going on next door. So all day long, all you could hear was next door going, bum 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 bum. So like Robert Cardoza's got the tune coming out of his head. It's like, you know, in my sleep, I'm hearing this. In my sleep. So one day, the fellow next door said, you know something? I've got tickets to see Yehuda Menuhin play Beethoven's violin concerto in Tel Aviv. Do you want to, I've got a ticket. Do you want to come? I don't want to come. I live and breathe that concerto. Of course I want to come. So they went together. And they started playing. And Rabbi Kudos said, he tapped the guy on the shoulder. He said, excuse me, there's something. No, it's fine. There's something not right here. And in the interval, he said, I don't understand. It doesn't seem to sound like anything that you're playing. I know the symphony. This concerto. It's not what you play. He says, of course it's what I play. No, but it sounds completely different. He goes, of course it sounds completely different. Because an amateur musician, when he plays Mozart, he plays Mozart. But when Menuhin plays it, he plays Menuhin. And he borrows the notes from Mozart. He doesn't play Mozart. And that's the point. That the symphony of Mozart is incredibly complex. And you cannot change the notes. If you change the notes, you kill the symphony. It's crafted in exactly the perfect way. We're going to put a drum beat to Mozart? That's not going to do it. You're going to kill Mozart. But does Mozart leave you the ability to put yourself into it? 100%. And we're going to see this in a very clear way in a couple of minutes from now. So the halachic system sets the framework for that discipline, that chesed and that gvura, and allows us then to put ourselves into it. We have to be menuhin. You know what it's like if anyone's a musician here playing scales? You know how heart-destroying, soul-destroying it is to play scales all day if you're learning to play? All day long. You think, well, how is this ever going to turn me into anything? The answer is, if you actually look into the music that's real music, you play Beethoven's piano concerto, Emperor Piano Concerto, half of it's scales. And then you think, oh my goodness, I'm not just playing scales now, I'm playing music. Without the ability to play the scale, I wouldn't even be able to begin, but now it's way beyond the scale. Because it has to have you in it. And that's the truth of halacha. Some people in life, unfortunately, in halacha are still playing scales. That's tragic. You can't be playing scales. That's the discipline you need to put yourself into it. And without further ado, let me play you some music. What I want to do is I want to play you a clip of music. But I want to play you this clip of music 10 times. Recorded by different conductors with different orchestras over the last 90 years. Okay? And I want you to see how all of them have exactly the same music. Would never chas v'chalila change a note of the music. But how each rendition sounds quite different to the next. Because they've put themselves into it and made it their own personal piece. This is the first 16 or so bars of Mozart's 40th symphony. Okay? It's a famous symphony. It's a G minor symphony. I'll tell you a little bit about it. And you'll recognize it as soon as I play it for you, you'll recognize it. Mozart wrote this in 1788. He was having a hard time. His personal life, his professional life were on the rocks. His wife had been very sick, his daughter had just died, and he was having a very hard time. He wrote this symphony in G minor, and if anybody's into Mozart, they'll know that G minor is a very rare key for Mozart to write in. He wrote 41 symphonies, I should say, and all but two of them were written in the major key, only two were in the minor key, of which one is this one, and both were in G minor. It's a key that that projects sadness, intensity, lamentation, suffering, anxiety. And if anyone knows anything else that wrote in G minor, they'll be able to put that together. I'm happy to talk to you about it afterwards. So what I want to do first is let's hope the technology works. I'm just going to play it for you once so you can hear it. And then I'm going to tell you what I think you should be looking out for. So let's try this. Okay, everybody ready? Here we go. Is it loud enough?
Yes.
I can make it a bit louder.
Yes.
You know the music, right? You've heard it before. So if you turn over, you'll see the sheet music's on the back here. Now, I don't know if you read music. It doesn't matter if you don't read music. But you can see there's basically a few things going on here. First of all, you've just got strings basically playing, and they're doing two different things. You've got violas doing a kind of motor underneath, going da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-
how you're going to balance those tunes. Mozart doesn't tell you which to bring out more, which to bring out less. You have to decide that within the music.
How fast are you going to play it? Well, Mozart wrote on here Allegro Molto. Allegro Molto means very fast, okay? But how fast is very fast? It's a little bit of a relative question. Also, you have how loud are you going to play it? Well, you see, the first thing is written as a little P at the bottom. So P stands for piano, which means quiet. But again, how quiet is quiet? It's really something of a judgment call. And also then you've got a question of phrasing. How are you going to phrase this? Mozart didn't phrase it for you. Are you going to phrase it in two bars, like na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na? Na 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 na, meaning every two bars, or you're going to do four bar phrasing. Na 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 na. Was that the same thing?
Yeah.
Oh, say it the other way. Four bar phrasing. Na 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 na. How are you going to phrase it? How are you going to do that? So those questions are all questions that the conductor has to answer, and a good music listener, which is I'm not as good as others, can even spot the conductor from listening to a performance. They can listen to a performance and say, oh yes, that must be whatever it is, because they can tell the way that they did it. So what I'm going to do is, let's listen to this again, let's see how different people do different things with the same music, and you'll see the difference. So let's just listen to that first one again. This, the first one, is Neville Marriner, Sir Neville Marriner, and the Orchestra of St. Martin in the Fields, which is a well-known British orchestra, and he's playing this. You'll see the speed in there. Ready. Well, he went a bit of a swell at the end. Oh, at the end. Now, the Mozart didn't say to do that at the end. Na, 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 na. He decided to do that. He wanted to put that swell in at the end. How fast was he playing it? I actually timed it. It's 112 beats per minute. Which is actually a touch on the slow side for Allegro Molto, but okay, he wanted to play it a bit slower, and his phrasing is more four bars. Listen again. Then up, down. So it's a four bar phrasing. And then he wants to get louder at the end. Now, listen to Bruno Walter. Bruno Walter likes playing things very slowly and very passionately. He's brought it right down to 95 beats per minute. This is the Columbia Symphony Orchestra. I don't have it here. But listen to this. It's got less. Oh, he goes a little bit there. And you notice as well, if you listen carefully, each of the notes is a bit shorter. Na 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 na. It's like it's more punctuated as opposed to the first one. And he was a little bit slower as well. This is Carl Berman, the Vienna Philharmonica, and he really takes it to the extreme. He's really strumming away. Now you tell me if that's Allegro Molto. He's taking a little bit of liberty with that. You know, okay, that's his minhag. He's fitting in with the halacha. He's not changing the halacha of Mozart. But his minhag is pushing at the edges a little bit. And he wants to make it like that. Also, he's playing the whole thing very slow. And I think he's bringing out the Molto in the background a lot more. Just listen to that again. All the scrubbing that the violist does. What's that? It sounds that way, doesn't it? Listen to the motor action at the bottom. It's almost like a pneumatic drill. there's something Israeli. Since it's not Jewish music you're listening to, it's Mozart. This is the Israeli Camerata. Now, Israelis are always in a rush. Okay? Because they've always got somewhere to go. Right, you like that speed better, it suits you better. But get on with it. No, yalla. And also, now listen to something much older. Toscanini is a very famous conductor from the 20s and the 30s, and you'll see that he plays it almost like a black and white 1930s silent film. Yeah? Very, all with a musical band, very melodramatic. You can hear, listen to the vibrato of the violins. It's like, and there's almost like a sliding up and down. It's very schmaltzy. You would say today, far too schmaltzy for Mozart, in my opinion. Okay, listen to this. It's subtle, but it's there. Let's play that one again. Okay. They probably all sound the same by now. Listen. I can almost imagine some woman with her head on the back of a chaise lounge, like, you know, thinking, oh, like a little bit like that. Doctor, good afternoon. The next one I have a personal stake in. Yes, madam?
I like them all.
You like them all. Well, hopefully you like this one. This one is, the recording is bad, because this one was my orchestra playing in 1989. And it was my dad sitting in the back of the hall with a tape recorder. Okay? So the first thing you'll notice is it's gone down a semitone. So I'm actually playing this in F sharp minor, but I played it in G minor, but just the recording is so bad it slowed the whole thing down. But it actually sounds quite nice. But this is mine. If you don't like it, I won't take offense. Bad. I'm not sure it's as good as Toscanini, but you know, the way to go. And the orchestra got good reviews, you should know. I mean, it was a long time ago, 1989, and my wife did think it was very romantic. I was a conductor at the time, so at least that was good. Let me just finish off with something which I really connected with when I was trying to work out how to bring my impact on the music. And again, what we've done here is shown, I think, that you don't ever change the notes, but you make the music your own. The way that a classical overture works, and by the way, a classical symphony rather, and by the way, Mozart's 40th symphony was very much on the cusp between classical and romantic. It's seen as being the turning point in many ways of, you know, going into Beethoven, which was the romantic period. What Mozart does is he plays a lot around with, in the recapitulation, puts some things in that were not there before. Well, how does that work? You have an opening, like we've heard this theme, na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na-na. Then you have a development, which is basically, he plays around with the different keys that it's in, he runs around, and you end up back where you started from, but not quite the same. And when I was listening to different recordings of this, when I was conducting it, I was thinking to myself, there's something there that I like. What is it? It's different from the beginning. What's changed? And I want you to see if you can listen out for it, and you'll see there's a bassoon. There's a bassoon which is playing a plaintive sort of counter theme over the top, which was never there at the beginning. And I realized what it was. Listen carefully. You probably think I'm a bit crazy, but listen carefully. Okay. This will sound a bit different because it's when it's coming back in again at the end. He's getting back into the theme. Listen. There's like a chiming. Now listen. Did you hear it? Did you hear it? I'll play it again. There's a bassoon in the background going, na, 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 na. Okay. Listen to this one more time. Sorry. You can hear it kind of chiming in the back there. It's going to be the hearing aid, isn't it? Here. You heard it that time? I hope you heard it that time. When I heard that, I loved it. And I said to the bassoonist, I want you to play that a bit louder. They said, really? I said, just indulge me. This is my little imprint on Mozart. Mozart wrote that bassoon line. He wrote it for a reason. I want it to come out. I want people to hear it in the hall because it's a special, just to me, I like that. And then I remember in the concert, that little moment when that came out, that was my minag in Mozart. That was Manning's minag in Mozart, okay? But I wouldn't change the notes. I wouldn't dream of that. But the personality that you can, and I'm an amateur, you know, I can't do the thing properly. If you're serious, if you know what you're doing, if you watch rehearsals of Leonard Bernstein is perhaps one of the greatest masters in conducting, see how he develops an orchestra, how he brings in an orchestra, how he puts his own imprint on that. It's really quite unbelievable. But we're going to have to leave it there because it's 5:45. But I think that the idea is very clear, which is that the magic of halacha is never in changing the notes. That turns into putting a drum beat to music. The magic is in the dynamic, in the phrasing, in the speed. And that's you. And in halakhic terms, that's the minhagim and the family minhagim and the way you do things and your personality. Your personality has to shine through the halakha, and in that way the halakha will be meaningful. And then you retain both. You retain the discipline and the input and the personality, and hopefully you end up with a symphony. You don't end up with scales, but you end up with a symphony which will carry through life. And hopefully people see that and they realize that, you know, just to finish off with, the Midrash says that Moshe Rabbeinu was like the sun. And Yeshua was like the moon. What does that tell us? Well, Yeshua didn't dream of creating his own light. Yeshua reflected only the light of the sun, only the light of Moshe Rabbeinu, not his own light. But when you look at the moon, it doesn't look like the sun. It looks like the moon. It uses the light of the sun, and then it looks like itself, with its own craters and its own personality. And therefore, combining those two things together is, I think, what we're really looking for. Thank you very much. I wish you a wonderful afternoon. Yes.